Welcome to another episode of the Rational Faith Podcast. I'm Brian Dillman.
And I'm Brian Kissel.
Rational Faith is a Mormon-based blog and podcast seeking to provide a safe, fair, and balanced space to discuss the complexities, difficulties, and beauty of our Mormon tradition.
Yep, in an entertaining and informal way, we're dedicated to exploring the vital, applicable, and expansive topics that we're always wrestling with as Mormons, while simultaneously keeping Mormonism weird.
Always striving to keep Mormonism weird. Today, we have a fun episode. I had an interview with an old friend of mine where we both talked with Steve Peck. Steve Peck is an author of, well, he's an evolutionary biologist at BYU, first of all. He's also authored several books and lots of short stories and poetry, fictional stuff. And so it was a lot of fun talking with him. Have you read any of his work, Brian?
I have. I'm actually a pretty big fan. I've only read A Short Stay in Hell from him, which is... I loved it. I've listened and read it a couple different times, and but the other place that I'm aware of him from is just an interview, a different podcast episode where he was interviewed, and it was one of my favorite podcast episodes I've ever heard from Sarah Collette. And what I loved about it was just he really resonated with me. I mean, he's this faithful individual who he just loves science. When you're listening to him discuss some of these different topics and or whatever he's discussing, I think he comes at it from this extremely thoughtful and very persuasive and scientifically backed, I think, perspective. So I really enjoy him. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a fun guy to talk to. He's, you know, We talked about four different writings of his. We talked about The Scholar of Moab, which has won several awards. We've talked about A Short Stay in Hell, and a essay from the journal Dialogue called Two Dog Dose, and then a children's book called Riffs of Rhyme, which is really, really interesting. I haven't read it. My friend that I had on had read all of these. I've read Short Stay in Hell, and I've read the Dialogue article, the Dialogue essay. And the thing that I find really interesting and enjoyable about Steve is you can ask him questions, and you can say, were you trying to do this? Were you trying to get this across? And he never really says, no, that's not what I was trying to do at all. he's very much open to, oh yeah, that's a different way to look at it. So Steve is really open to different interpretations, different ways to look at his books, different ways to look at the gospel. And I find that really appealing. And for me, that's the way it has to be, because we all are complex individuals and different people are going to look at things in different ways. So I think his writing, it shows a lot of different ways to think about maybe aspects of the gospel, maybe just life, hard questions. And a lot of his work is really designed to be open-ended.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think there are so many different people who react to, I don't know, differing questions and things in this like defensive way. And I think we're kind of... that's kind of part of our culture, but it's always really refreshing when you have individuals who are just willing to talk about different things. That's one of the things that I really liked about Joanna Brooks during the Mitt Romney campaign, and I followed her pretty closely because people would be asking different questions, and she was never like, no, wait, that's not, you can't say that or whatever. She would just answer the questions, and she was always so, I felt so respectful of everybody involved with considering the church as well as considering other things. And that's definitely the vibe that I get from Stephen Peck as well.
Yeah, that's really appealing. So, one other thing that we need to announce, I actually think in the Sarah Collette interview they talked about this, but I forgot to bring it up. But the book A Short Stay in Hell is being made into a movie. And
What? I didn't even know that. That is so awesome.
absolutely. And someone picked it up, and I sent a quick message to him the other day and verified it, and he said it's pretty close to going into production. Hopefully it'll get to some of the bigger film festivals like Sundance or something like that. So that's something super, super exciting to look forward to, I think.
Oh, that is really cool, yeah.
Yeah. So listeners, get ready. This is going to be a preview to a couple really great works by a fun Mormon author. And I've read two of them, and now the other two are on my list or in my Amazon cart already. So be prepared to buy a couple more books and get reading again. Some fun, really, really fun Mormon fiction. So they're very thought-provoking, but they're kind of a nice breather from studying history or studying the scriptures or something, because they're easier to read, but they still make you ponder, hard questions. All right, so today I have one of our favorite professors, Steve Peck, on to talk about some of the things that he's written, and a friend of mine, Benjamin Knoll, who's read a lot of Steve's work. Ben, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you've been involved with?
Sure. So my name is Benjamin Knoll. I live in Central Kentucky in Danville. I work at Center College here. It's a smart liberal arts college. I teach political science classes here. And that's been good. I am currently the Elders Quorum president in our ward. I like Mormon studies stuff. I did one stint on Jared Anderson's Sunday School podcast. Listened to a bunch of them, and I've read several of Stephen's books here. So I was excited to jump at the chance to be able to participate.
Oh, well, I'm honored.
Yeah.
Great. Maybe to get to know Steve a little bit more, I've prepared a little quiz. Rather than telling us about your life story, I think this quiz will tell us a lot more. So you've written a lot of tests as a professor, so I
That's
think you can
right.
handle this.
I come up with, I guess.
Okay, so paper or plastic?
Paper.
Okay, Star Wars or Star Trek?
Star Trek.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Yes, he's sure. Yes.
Yeah. I don't even have to hesitate on that one.
Tolkien or C.S. Lewis?
Tolkien.
Willow or Mad Mardigan?
Willow.
Mountains or a beach?
Mountains.
City or country?
Country.
And finally, Doctrine and Covenants 132 or Jacob 2?
Jacob too.
That's a good answer. Very good, safe answer. All right. So anyway, I thought that was kind of fun. But we want to talk about. I have a little online book group, and we read A Short Stay in Hell,
Oh.
and I thought it was a lot of fun. And I was actually really kind of surprised because you're a scientist.
Right.
But this isn't a, I mean, it kind of has some sciencey sort of stuff in it, but it's different. It feels like something I would read in an English class or maybe a philosophy class or something. So how did you go from counting legs on insects or messing with stuff in a petri dish or whatever it is to writing books? Have you always liked to write? Tell
Oh,
us a little bit how you got into telling stories.
yeah, I've always loved to write. I've always done it on the side. I mean, even when I was a little kid. In fact, I remember in seventh grade, I wrote this poem about a weasel. And the kid who incessantly picked on me and bullied me came up after with tears in his eyes and said, "That was the best thing you've ever done." And at that moment, I knew that writing had power.
Cool. So,
I've always loved to write. It's just something I do.
do you ever, does that take away from your science work, or does it feed in together? Because I mean, I have a degree in chemistry and chemical engineering, and so I'm kind of more of a numbers guy. Uh-huh. And sometimes, like, I've written a couple blog posts. I go from writing a technical paper to writing something more like a narrative or a story, and my sentences are so short and choppy that the story doesn't flow very well. Do you have to sort of change gears going from writing a research paper or reviewing a research paper and writing like A Short Stay in Hell or The Scholar of Moab?
Yeah, I kind of do, and I think I actually – it keeps me sane. At least it keeps me sane. I do have to switch gears. My doctorate is actually in biomathematics, so I've got this really quantitative side, but I found that the imaginative side, by building that, actually makes me a better scientist. Just learning how to imagine different worlds or different solutions and things. So that's always been sort of fun for me to play with both sides of my brain, as small as it is.
You've got finite matter to work with there. Yeah, I think that's cool. I mean, I feel the same way. When I started my PhD, I walked into a advisor that already had a grant, and so I felt like I was boxed in at first, and I had to do all the research within these objectives, and you know, it felt really constrictive for a while, but then I started doing whatever I wanted and then kind of selling it as if it were within those objectives.
Yeah, yeah.
So the creativity is really important, I think, to actually do something.
Actually, creativity is actually a really important part of science. So it helps.
Okay, well, why don't you take us through just a list of the things that you've written. What's out there? I mean, I'm aware of A Short Stay in Hell because I've read it. What are some of the other things that you've written?
Okay, so the other big work that I did was The Scholar Moab. And that one won the best Mormon novel. The Association of Mormon Letters gave it the best novel of 2011. And it's really different. It's kind of a magical realism book. And then I have a children's book, Rifts of Rhyme, about squirrels. And what I did, I used to read to my kids these animal books like Redwall and things. And I got kind of tired of the animals not being animals. They were just kind of like people in animal costumes. And so I was trying to imagine what an evolved, intelligent race of squirrels would, what would their culture be like? What would their concerns be? So I gave them a religion and gave them, you know, some poetry and some things like that. And so that's my other book. I actually have a book of poetry out. It was just recently reviewed by the science fiction. It's the Science Fiction Poetry Association. They gave it a really positive review.
Okay.
And I have a small book that was published by Covenant Communications. It's kind of a Christmas story, long out of print, but that was actually the first one that ever got published. And then I have loads of stories published in the science fiction world, mostly.
Oh, cool. All right, well, that's good. That's a good sort of 10,000-foot view, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with The Scholar of Moab. And, Ben, you jump in whenever, because you've read more of this stuff than me. So jump in and let's just talk about some of these, what the basic premise is and some of the questions that the book might be asking or might cause us to ask.
Sure. So with this book, I'm just curious. So this is I read this. I immediately recommended it to both my mom and my sister. They both read it, and they loved it. They thought it was great. And so one of the questions that we had coming out of us just talking about afterwards is first, what in the world was, like, the motivation for this book? Like, what inspired this story to come into being? Was it like a personal experience? Is this just something that popped into your head one day? Where'd it come from?
So I grew up in Moab, kind of. We moved there when I was in the early part, right as I was beginning high school. And it really kind of framed who I was in a lot of ways. We'd moved around a lot, and Moab was the first place we sort of settled in. And I just got to know the people really well. It was my experiences there, you know, being Mormon in Moab, and, you know, a lot of the things that appear in there that seem almost absurd really were things that happened to me.
Does this include the two-headed cowboy?
No.
Okay.
That's actually, in fact, you know, this actually kind of illustrates how this comes to me, because I originally was just writing about Hiram Thayne and what he was doing in his quest to become a scholar, and I was writing a scene with him and Dora, and all of a sudden they wrote up. I mean, literally in my mind they wrote up, and I thought, oh my word, I've got to add them. And that's when the book really took off. And I had to go back and rewrite it from the beginning. And, so the two-headed cowboy just rode up one day, you know, just, you know, in the dust of the LaSalles, they they appeared. So maybe I'll tell what the characters are, so this will make a little sense. So the book's put together by a redactor who's never named. He sort of connects the dots. He's the one gathering the documents and doing some of the interviews of people. And the question surrounding everything is questions about what happened back when Hiram Thayne became famous in Moab, and there was the death of a baby. There was his own death, and the redactor. The story opens with the redactor talking about the statue raised to Hiram thing that got dragged out into the sloughs one night by teenagers. But it sets up that he's quite famous. And then as you're introduced to him, he's a high school dropout. He's gone through various experiences that he wants to become a scholar. But I think those are the funnier parts of the book.
That was the most endearing part of the whole story, I thought, reading that there.
Yeah. The other character is Dora Tanner. She's a poet who lives in Moab, and most of the people think she's insane. She's non-Mormon because she believes she was abducted by aliens and horrifically treated, and so most people think she's insane. The book leaves open the question of whether that was a real event or not. And so I don't even know. the other character, and I think my favorite of all, is the Babcock twins. They're Oxford educated conjoined twins. And there's actually another character. There's a neural mass in their spine that decides who gets to feel the legs. And so it can trade the feeling and control of the legs to one or the other, or the twins. But that seems rather minimal, but you can tell that this entity is making decisions and leading them places by allowing the twin who will sort of do what it wants to have the legs. And then, so those are the four characters: the redactor, Hiram Thayne, Dora Tanner, and the conjoined twin cowboys. And from there, it's hard to describe exactly, because it is so different. But
interesting.
So that was that. And so for me, you know, what motivates a story is it's always almost just an organic process. A group of characters will capture me, and all of a sudden I'm thinking about what they do, what happens, and I get surprised sometimes. I'll be riding along and suddenly, you know, in mid sentence, say to myself, "Wow, I didn't see this coming." You know, I'm as surprised as the reader. So for me, it's kind of a very organic process. So it's not, you know, it wasn't like I thought, oh, there's an agenda here. I'm going to write a story about that combines science and philosophy. It just flows out of me.
Steve, have you noticed when these ideas come, is it like a typical pattern? Like, is it reading something else that makes an idea come up, or is it walking in the desert in the area of Moab, or is it kind of random, or is there something that you do that typically will precipitate a new idea?
A lot of times I'd say it's more things walking outside or doing things. The Scholar Moab, I actually started it a long time ago, and I had written maybe 30 pages, and it was just Hiram Thain. And all of a sudden, I was on my sabbatical in Vienna, and I was there working on tsetse fly things, and it just, I thought I ought to pull out that Hiram Thain story, and I reread it, and it's essentially his first journal entry I had written, and all of a sudden the other characters began to appear, the plot line started to appear, and the next thing I knew it was just rolling, it was happening, and it's not completely a linear process. You know, sometimes somebody, like when the Babcock twins wrote up, they had to be rewritten. I had to go back and rewrite them into the story, and that changed the story itself, and new possibilities and directions appeared. And so it's kind of a back and forth, nonlinear, you know, just mostly imaginative work, and then actually writing it. And It was fun. A lot of it, there was a little breakfast shop right below our apartment, and my wife and kids had to leave early to get back to school. And so I'd go in the mornings and I'd sit in that Vienna cafe and type, and I thought, oh, this is the life. This is just like the writers back in the 20s, you know?
Yeah, sort of a romantic, idealistic situation.
Well, you know, Ernest Hemingway in Paris kind of experience.
Yeah. There
you
go.
Well, that is talent, but it was fun to pretend.
Yeah, no, that's cool. So that reminds me, when you talk about the non-linearity of the book, so that brings up an interesting point about the book itself, which is, it's not a traditional narrative the way the book's written. You know, it's essentially a source of primary historical documents, all kind of pasted together, and the reader is just kind of left to themselves to try to figure out, okay, so what's the actual story when you've got these conflicting versions of what's going on? And I thought that was really creative. That was an interesting way to try to tell a story from these multiple kinds of viewpoints, which don't always, which didn't always agree with one another. There seemed to be contradictions.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, there's questions about sanity for one of them. And, you know, one of them clearly a not very reliable narrator.
Mm-hmm.
he's not telling the deep things that are going on around him. And
no, it was a fun book. I remember at the end of it, as I was going through the conversations with my sister and trying to figure out, okay, so what does this book mean? Like, what's the bigger lesson or message that's trying to come away from this? Anyways, what I took away from it is, in talking with some of my historian friends, they talk about how the past is ultimately unknowable to us because all we have is the past as interpreted through the documents that speak to the events that occurred. And oftentimes, like, the art of history or historiography is putting together the story that's told from these different documents to try to put an interpretation on it to then reconstruct these past events. And so, like, as I'm reading this book, that's what I'm thinking, is that nobody knows exactly what happened in the story because all we have of it is interpretations from these various documents and viewpoints, and that's the best we're going to be able to get, which I thought had all sorts of interesting applications for, like, you know, Mormon history and American, you know, just anything in the world.
Yeah, I think that's valid. I think that's one of the things that you can draw from the book is this sense of how do we know what we know? And I play with that with Hiram's experiments on faith and things. But yeah, I think that's right. I think that we can't really construct the past well. We don't really know what exactly happened because we only get bits and pieces of the complete story. And I think that's what the book tries to mimic. So yeah. I don't think anybody's ever said that before, but yeah.
Yeah, no, that's what I took away from it. That was yeah. A big lesson to me is maybe this is a good thing for us to think about for those of us interested in like church history issues and other historical issues. To what extent can we ever actually really know what happened in these important events in our lives?
Exactly. So you have all the witnesses there, and they all tell a different story, and mm-hmm. and they make choices about what they hold back or what they reveal. Based on their own self-interest and what they want to tell. And
mm-hmm, so exactly,
That's real history, I think.
Yeah, that sounds like reality. Sounds like what people do. Well, that's, I've had that on my list, so now I feel like I have to move it up my list a little bit of stuff to read. Short Stay in Hell, I think the Mormon Stories group did a interview with you, what was that, a year ago or 2 years ago?
Yeah, it may have been. I'm losing all track of time. I'll say something to somebody, yeah, that was last year. I'll say, no, that was 4 years ago. And I'll say, really?
Well, this is the type of book that forces you to lose track of time. I think that fits really well. So the funny thing I thought was, as I looked into this book before I had read it, the most common word that came up describing it was disturbing.
Yeah.
or depressing. I had that one too.
Or depressing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, and I came away with it like I didn't feel disturbed or depressed at all. I thought it was just super neat. And maybe that's just because I like open-ended stuff,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
So anyway, Why don't you tell us in brief what A Short Stay in Hell is?
Okay, so it opens it opens in a far distant future, and somebody's recounting their life in hell, and they make reference to some uncanny length of time that really doesn't make any sense till you get to the end. And it opens with a Mormon guy's death. The character finds himself sitting in a chair in an office with a demon, whereas he was expecting to be greeted by his family and loved ones and in a touching reunion. And instead, he's on some hard metal chairs in an office with a sort of a classic goat-footed demon, and he's told that he missed his opportunity to join the one true religion, which turns out to have been Zoroastrianism. And he is sent to a hell, and it has a kind of a sign there every few feet, but it's based essentially on Jorge Borges' story, the Library of Babel, and a library of all the books that could be written of a certain size, which turns out to be all the books possible. And it's his story. It's the story of his stay in this hell, his interactions there, the realizations that this is going to be his life for a while. And the demon tells him, and this is why it's called A Short Stay in Hell, that he won't be there forever. It's an opportunity to be instructed. So that's the opening.
Yeah. And so by the possible books that could be written, this is not the possible number of ideas that a human mind could come up with.
No.
Describe what you mean by the possible books that could be written.
So any book, for example, there's a book on the shelf of all A's, and there's a book on the shelves of all A's with one I in the middle of the book. And there's a book of probably multiple volumes of War and Peace, and War and Peace, where the main character, instead of Pierre, is named Fred. and another one where it's named Wilma. And so it's all possible books, most of them being nonsense. The random strings of text that you open a book and there's absolutely no meaning. And the task in hell is you have to find the book with your life story in it and put it into a slot.
So it's kind of like that poor analogy with evolution, where if you put a monkey in a room with a typewriter and he bangs on it, then it comes out as Shakespeare. Right. But you're actually saying that's what it is. So you have a random keyboard character generator, and you get every possible sequence given the number of character spaces within that book.
Right.
Yeah. So I mean, it's a short book. I think I read it in an afternoon or two afternoons or something.
Yeah.
But it really forces you to think about what infinity means.
Right.
And so that was really neat, because we talk about eternity every Sunday. We talk about eternal this and that, and we talk about every math class you have infinity, you know, as it approaches infinity, you know, a certain function will approach zero or whatever.
Right.
We throw these out there, but we don't really sit and contemplate how big infinity really is, or a number that even approaches that.
Right.
So that's one thing that I found really fun in reading it, was it illustrated what that word really means.
And for me, it was the same experience writing it. I realized when I was finished that I'd never really understood eternity, and you're right, it just rolls off of our tongue all the time. But when you put kind of a face on it, it's terrifying. And I think that's why people say it's disturbing. It is disturbing. Eternity is really long.
it's kind of a short
segment of it.
Yeah. Ben, you were going to say
I was going to say, it just says, you know, the idea of living forever always sounds like so, we just say it so glibly. It's like, oh yeah, we're going to live forever. Of course. And
that sounds wonderful.
Without thinking through the implications. So what's that going to be like in 20 billion trillion years? Like
right,
what's,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that'll just be not even a fraction of infinity.
Yeah, yeah. Like in times longer than the universe has existed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the time frames that goes on here.
Yeah. So for me, it was much the same experience. I mean, when I was writing it, I'd actually lie awake in bed at night thinking about it, kind of being there. It's kind of like hanging over the abyss, like, wait a second.
Yeah. I think that's the disturbing part. It's kind of like you drop someone in the middle of the ocean, or you drop someone in the middle of the Gobi Desert, but it's even bigger than that. And you know, they don't die, because part of the story is they're healed every day.
Right.
But they have the same mundane experience every day, looking at nonsensical books. And, you know, the thing that once I got going, I'm like, how is this thing going to build up, because it's this guy looking at books in a library that don't make any sense, but you end up building a story in there, and like they build a university, or they have a class anyway.
Yeah, they try to construct meaning, and the interesting thing is for me, I mean, I talk like I didn't write it, because in some ways it just again comes to me, and it was interesting to me that they began to try to construct some meaning to their lives using the old forms they knew from their Earth life. So that was I think probably the surprise for me as well, if I can be surprised in my own book.
So that was pretty unsettling for a lot of people, and I'm wondering, with this focus on infinity, or this focus on eternities, and then, you know, you start to think how, you know, like the thing that struck me was thinking about Mormon theology with our three kingdoms, and we're living forever, and, you know, in sort of the very simplified version, you act a certain way, either you're a good person, or you're not a denier of the Holy Spirit, then you go to the lowest kingdom, and you're a half decent person and you go to the middle one. But only Mormons go to the Mormons that keep all the commandments and receive their ordinances and keep the covenants, actually get to the top one. And if we were to ask Elder McConkie, he would say that's the one where you have eternal increase and you can actually continue to progress and grow and do these other things. So it, in some ways, thinking about this damning between kingdoms and thinking hard about infinite time, those other kingdoms start to not feel like much of a glorious reward. They feel like eventually you're going to run out of things. Right. You're going to get bored. Right. You're going to go crazy, and it's going to feel like a hell.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah.
So is this sort of a veiled critique of the theology where, you know, this obscure religion, Mormonism, is really dictating all the billions of people that have ever lived on the planet and basically consigning the vast majority of them to hell?
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought of it quite that way, but I think that view has merit in the sense that that's what the demon says to one of the Christians in there. He says, well, you're going to send people to a worse hell than this, you know, a burning fiery hell. And, you know, that was pretty cruel. and in a sense, you're right. We're doing the same. And I think for me, it was a critique that I have a hard time imagining the eternities are just, sort of increase, just eternal increase. You know, having more kids or, you know, more whatever. I think it has to be a place of where there's always more to learn, more to grow, more to, I know Elder McConkie was of the opinion that this God already had stopped growing. And I'm not sure I'm convinced of that. And I know there's other general authorities that agree with that view. I think heaven has to be a dynamic place where at least as societies grow, and you know, Joseph Smith talked about how we'll have that same society there as we do here. And I think there's something to that. In fact, a friend of mine pointed out, he said, you know, if I were in that hell, of the short stay in hell, he said, I think I would just give up the quest completely and try to build a society that had meaning and developed art and literature and just forgot the task completely. And I think there's some merit in that idea that the eternities have to be kind of constructing more meaning, more opportunity and growth. And, you know, having all the scientific facts doesn't mean that you've learned everything that a society could become, or all artwork or all literature could, you know. I think it's a dynamic place. I think it's a place of ecological growth and meaning, where meaning grows and grows and grows. And part of the reason I think that too is, like the book, that Terrell and Fiona Gibbons wrote, The God Who Weeps. I think we have to have a God who can be affected. And if you know everything and are completely static, you can't be affected by anything. If you see all futures, it's a lifetime of Gilligan's Island reruns, which would make an interesting hell story too. You know, you've seen it all.
There you
yeah?
go. Yeah.
I knew that was gonna happen. I knew that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it loses the suspense yeah. and the tension and all that.
Right, because you see God weeping in the Pearl of Great Price at the wickedness of his children. And so new truths arise from just societies that you really can't predict, from the interaction of people, from the new things, the novelty that comes out of human interaction. I mean, you look at our own society over the last 50 years alone. We live in such a wildly different world, and it's all because of people thinking through inventions and creating a new society, you know, based on technology, the ability that we can do this, is all this novelty. No one could have predicted. No one saw it coming. Yeah. And yet, it gives us new opportunities for interaction, for truth, for all kinds of things. And for me, that's the way I think heaven has to be. So if the book is a critique of anything, it's the idea that it's a static, you know, wake up, do the same thing every day kind of heaven. Because I don't think that would be very heavenish.
Yeah. I think at best that's a caricature of heaven that feels comfortable because it's something that we can generally wrap our minds around, that it's happiness.
Right.
So happy's good. So we'll go with that.
Right.
But there was actually, as you were talking about, heaven being dynamic and God feeling pain or, frustration or whatever it is that caused, God to weep or causes. I was thinking there was this, Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a Buddhist teacher.
Right.
He was interviewed, and he said something to the effect of, if heaven or the afterlife has no suffering, he wouldn't want to be there.
Right, right.
And the reason was that there's no progress, and there's no real appreciation of goodness or happiness if you don't have the other. And that kind of fits in with our scriptures that, you know, there's opposition in all
exactly.
things.
Interesting.
And, yeah, there's no reason that we only have opposition here, and, you know, we see that opposition, I mean, we get used to a stable life. You get paid more money, and you feel really good for a little while, like you graduate school and you get a real job,
yeah.
But then you get used to that.
Yeah.
And so you have to have continual challenges.
Morning, right. Yeah, mm-hmm. I heard a philosopher say, and I wish I could remember his name, but he was talking about, you know, what he would want in heaven. He says, you know, to me it seems like the typical view of heaven is nothing that more than a big, you know, shot of heroin. You know, it happens forever and ever. Yeah, fix me up again. You know, it's
yeah.
That's not really a meaningful life. And I think that's right. I think meaning requires opposition and novelty and challenges. And yeah, that's the heaven for me.
Yeah, that's kind of what Short Stay in Hell made me think of is. These simplified versions of our theology, they're not very satisfying when you really think about what's it going to be like.
Right. Yeah.
So,
and so it sort of demands that you rethink that and think, heaven's got to be a place of novelty and excitement, and not excitement like, you know, amusement park, but, you know, genuine. Weeping and laughter and the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I can put in really quick before we move on to the next one. Mm-hmm. The thing that this book caused me to be self-reflective about is if eternity, like in that conception of it being a really, 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 really long time, and I thought, so there's differences of opinion amongst the general authorities as to whether or not there's the ability to progress from kingdom to kingdom in the afterlife. Someone who's originally in the celestial kingdom, would they have the opportunity to say if they made the choices, if they progressed to the certain point that they could, say, move up to the terrestrial kingdom or not? I was kind of more in the no progression camp in an earlier stage in my life, but then this book made me reflect on that idea. Is like, is that really, really, really what God would do, is consign someone to that place literally forever, even if they wanted to 30 billion eons from now decide, okay, now I'll shape up, I'll do what I need to do, any way I can progress a bit. And it made me more open to that idea and kind of see that as more of the kind of universe that I would want to live in, or the God I would want to believe in, is that there's always an opportunity, like even in the eons of billions of eternities, for everyone who wants to, who would be willing to make it to be available to them. So this book was a catalyst for me to think about a lot of those kinds of ideas about universalism, eternal progression, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I remember Eugene England was a big proponent of that. He was one of my favorite people when I was attending BYU, and it makes sense to me. Yeah, it's when you really get eternity, get a sense of it. It is frightening, and there's got to be responses to it that deal with that reality of its growth. I mean, of its terror.
Let's jump to a dialogue short story that you wrote.
Okay.
two-dog dose. I found this really interesting. I grew up in a semi-rural area, and the way that happened is we were one of the first, my parents were one of the first families to build a house in a rural area, and now it's not rural at all. But it was, you know, the way you had the characters talking to each other, and you had them kind of, one guy stayed in the sticks, the other guy, the other friend went and, you know, got his degree, and now he's a professor of English somewhere. Uh-huh. I related to that a lot, and the stupid things that they would say. I could imagine that. you know, the more people in New York don't talk that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't think
that
way.
Yeah, this is coming right out of my history too. I mean, it's like, yeah, these are the people I grew up with.
So did you go? Climbing around in mine shafts that you weren't supposed to go in?
Yep. Oh, yeah, I absolutely did. In fact, I remember coming upon boxes of old dynamite and off jars and shooting them with 22s, trying to get you know, we were just stupid stuff. yeah, that was...
It sounds like you two had a more adventuresome childhood than I did.
But Ben, now you're living in Kentucky. You're
indeed,
children can
indeed
have that kind of childhood. They can go pull snapping turtles out of ponds.
That's right, and learn how to ride horses and all that kind of good stuff. Yeah.
Okay, so that story. Were you thinking of specific people that you knew or friends that you've had, or was it just sort of the general? I don't know. How did you come up with that story?
It's kind of based on some close friendships that I've had with some friends, and you know, not exactly. There's huge literary license going on there, but I think that's what the story is really about, is about friendship. You know, these friendships that you would do anything for, you know, certain friends. And that I think was what the story was trying to draw out. You know, what if, you know, this depth of friendship requires really, really the ultimate sort of pressure to do something you almost think unthinkable until you do it. And I think that's probably what I was playing with in my mind, you know, with really good lifelong friends, you know, what do you do if something really, really hard is required of you? And, you know, the thing, I won't say what it is, so I don't give it away, but the requirements of friendship make demands, but should they make this level of demand is the hard question.
Can safely allude to the movie Million Dollar Baby.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
The dilemma that the decision that Clint Eastwood had to make.
Yeah.
It's a parallel to that, but with very close friends, not the sort of paternalistic relationship, but
right.
Close friends that are supposed to be there for each other and dealing with that sort of decision.
Right.
And so again, it's kind of like your theme here of being very disturbing. You've got a two-headed cowboy, eternity that's terrifying, and now this unthinkable dilemma that most people will never have to deal with, but probably some contemplate this sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, I teach bioethics, and this comes up as one of the main topics we talk about. You know, when, you know, euthanasia, when's it appropriate and when isn't it appropriate? And what do we do with this? And we look at lots and lots of cases. And we don't come to a decision. I kind of don't see bioethics as, you know, deciding to weigh in, but it's a way of evaluating all the choices that have to be made and what are the consequences of those choices. And, you know, where do you draw the line, or, you know, when does compassion overrule, some, letting somebody die or pulling the plug and things like this.
Right. So that was really interesting to me there. After I read the story, I came away with it thinking the author here is making an argument in support of human euthanasia. Is that, did I read correctly, or is that what you were writing as you're going into it, or did you want to leave it more open ended?
I think I wanted it more open ended. I think. I wasn't making, it's kind of assumed there. I mean, there's no real argument that I wanted to make.
Mm-hmm.
And my real thing was sort of the test of friendship. And if your friend asks you to do something, mm-hmm. you know, fairly, unpleasant, possibly even unethical in your mind, you know, how do you do it? How do you carry it? You know, in the story, I guess I can say this much, the story unfolds, you know, they've made a promise to each other long, long ago when it wasn't really an issue of reality. And then one of the friends calls, says, this is, you know, now we made a pact, you have to do this. And so I didn't want to weigh in because I've never even really made up my mind about it yet. And especially in a case like this, you know, it'd be a dilemma.
No, I had all sorts of sympathy for the characters involved in this story. It, you know, I was glad that I didn't have to be put in that situation myself, but I had all sorts of empathy or sympathy for those who I know are confronted with those sorts of issues in their lives.
Right. And because it's a real choice for some people. I mean, it comes down to this kind of choice. And so, yeah, this story even frightens me because I recognize that the potential for these kinds of events is very real, and people confront them all the time.
I don't know. That's tough. I don't think there's a good way to come down on that one.
And see, I think that's probably one of the things that define the way I write is I'm really focused on the problems, but not very good on solutions. I mean, things don't tidy up. and for me, this was like a painful story. I was surprised it was coming out.
Let's jump over to Riffs of Rhyme.
Okay.
You've told us a little bit about that, something with squirrels, and tell us about the story and like what age is a target or ideal age for kids reading this story.
So I think probably 10 and above. I mean, I do deal with difficult things in here. And it can be read on a lot of different levels. I think adults have enjoyed it as much as kids because of that. An adult will recognize, you know, a scene of torture that a kid wouldn't. He wouldn't pick up that what was going on was somebody who's being tortured, and an adult would, I think. And so it reads at different levels. And the basic idea is the story. I'll give you just a quick overview of it. The story takes place with a poetry teacher squirrel, and they have a form of poetry. They love languages. There's five races that have been animated by the Wieland, which are the gods of the world. And they're wolves and flying squirrels and gray squirrels and marmots.
And ants too, right?
Yeah, and ants. And they're called the strange animation because nobody's been able to talk to them, but all of their scriptures tell them that they're intelligent and can communicate. And so that, and the story plays on that. So the story opens, the flying squirrels are essentially, they don't know they can fly. They lost that knowledge, and they're seen as kind of a clumsy race that the gray squirrels, which are the warrior class, don't really appreciate. They're not good at jumping or flying or anything because they have this big fold of skin that keeps them clumsy, basically. And so they they love poetry. They love living simple lives. You know, if you made the comparison with Tolkien, they're kind of a hobbit equivalent. You know, they just love what they're doing. And the story opens with the leader prophet being poisoned by one of the military leaders who's taking over. And as the story unfolds, it's a lot about words and the way that literature plays, because the only thing that turns out that can save the people is the poetry that conveys the information of what's going on. Cause only a few people know that this beloved military leader is actually killed the prophet and taken over, and the story sort of unfolds with this idea of the flying squirrels finally realizing through poetry and through dreams that they can fly, which, you know, saves the day. It is a kid's story in that sense. But you recognize they're flying squirrels right away. When somebody blogged on the book once and they said, oh, it wasn't a surprise when they learned to fly. I could see it right from the beginning. And I thought, oh, I hope so. I wrote it that way. like they were disappointed that I'd been so obvious about the main fact. But I don't know. Maybe kids wouldn't pick up on that till the end. But I think adults and most of the kids that I know are pretty sharp. I mean, they grew up on Harry Potter, and they're not going to be too slow to realize what these little squirrels are.
No, that was good. This book here was one of, so I have to admit, if I had to pick a favorite, this is my favorite of the list of the books we've talked about so far.
Oh, good.
Yeah, no, it was great. I loved it. So the really clever parts of the book, I thought, were the squirrel scriptures that tell, like, yeah, the creation story and the quickening and all that, and Pinecone, and the main character, Pinecone's just a perfect name for a little squirrel, right? Yeah. His near-death experience, where he gets to meet some of the Wheelan there in the tree, right, with all that. You might be interested to know, I actually used that in a sacrament meeting talk that I gave on Mother's Day. It was great, because I talked about how, you know, I wanted to play up, like, okay, the mother image and Mormon doctrine and all that kind of thing, and so I shared I read that paragraph where Pinecone has the near death experience and he sees two squirrels, right? There's the mother and the father squirrel,
right?
And how it's the mother squirrel who's just so excited to see him, and she runs up and gives him a big hug, and it's the father squirrel that's kind of, you know, in the back and waiting. And I use that imagery to say, like, you know, what might that be like for us? You know, when the return missionary comes home, it's the mom who gives him the big hug, and the dad kind of stays in the back. And I just kind of use that to finish up the talk. Like, what might that be for us, you know, when we meet our heavenly parents? Who's going to be more excited to see us? You know, who's going to give us the big hug first? And so it was great. I was able to use that in that context.
You know, it's funny. This whole story came out of a sacrament meeting talk.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to the kids, and so I wrote a little, you know, it was only about a page and a half long story about a squirrel who didn't know his potential, that he was a flying squirrel, and then, you know, it was really different. You know, he just saves the day from some wolf or something, but that was the genesis of this. So yeah. Oh, interesting.
So these are some of the questions that occurred to me after reading this here. So I want to know, for you, to what extent is this book, are you intending to communicate like a metaphor of any parallels with humans and how we perceive God, consciousness, the quickening, any of these kinds of things? Is this, Are you meaning to make any kinds of arguments about there being any parallels with our conception of God being animals like us, just like for Pinecone, the Wheeland were two squirrels, just like him, right?
Yeah.
So talk about that.
And I think that's right, and especially in the sense, you'll notice that in the book there was a wide variety of opinion about what these scriptures meant. And it was all okay. Some people thought it was literal. Some people thought it was a metaphor. But everybody got along with that. You know, you kind of embraced what you felt, you know, was true.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that I was trying to drive. And you know, the obvious parallel with Heavenly Parents and everything, I was very explicit. You know, they were going to have a gendered God, two gendered God. I think that, you know, and I can't help but feel, even though I was trying to imagine what a squirrel religion and society would look like, but I just can't escape who I am and the, you know, the background that I have in religion. I think it bleeds into it. I tried hard though. I tried to make it kind of a more squirrely story than the other animal stories I've read. You know, they have their own unique mannerisms and tics and swear words and
so here's another question. So let's say one of the other Quicken species in this universe were to die and meet the deities. Would they be meeting squirrel deities as well? Or would they be meeting...
They would be. I think there's a couple places in the place where the wolves make reference to the squirrel deity. So everybody's on board with the squirrel deities. And it doesn't bother them that they're different or other. That's just the way it plays. In fact, they're gray squirrels. They're jet black gray squirrels.
So interesting.
Yeah.
So that just makes my mind go in all sorts of directions, right? Like, so with the possibility of there being other animals that could achieve sentience, or maybe creations and other, you know, and I'm just going totally bonkers on cosmology and all this kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
I'm trying to draw like parallels out of this. Like, what would it look like in other worlds? Evolution taking a different path, but also being quickened, you know, in a spiritual sense.
Right.
And how would they construct their gods? And for us, you know, how does that help us understand how we've also, to some extent, interpreted and constructed pictures of who God is and what they're like based on, you know, what we observe around us and that kind of thing.
Yeah. 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 Those are, I love questions like that. I've got a science piece coming out in the magazine Analog, the science fiction magazine, but it's a science fact thing on five wagers on what intelligent life will look like elsewhere in the universe. So.
No, that's a great book. So you said 10 and up. I was actually going to, I have a daughter who's nearly 6, and we had planned on starting to read that together next week-ish.
You know, I think it depends on the kid. I'm often surprised now what kids are reading at a young age. And so if she understands it, I'd say go for it.
Yeah, no, I think it'd be fun. That was a fun book. Okay, so final question on this book. When can we expect Rifts of Rhyme Part 2, the sequel?
Well, it's written. And
oh, no, okay, great.
Yeah, it's written. It's completely written. And Cedar Fort didn't make a lot of money on this book. Mm-hmm. They only sold like 750 copies, which is surprising. But they didn't market it at any... You know, Deseret Book or Seagull, maybe one or two Seagulls, you know, very, very little marketing of it. And so they didn't want to publish the sequel. So I don't know what's going to happen with it. It's great though. I like it even better. It's even more exciting. I mean, I wrote this maybe 15 years ago. And even though it was only published recently, and the new book is just, I'm so excited about it. It takes place 400 years later in a steampunk world of squirrels and, it's really exciting. Same culture, new enemy, new exciting enemy that doesn't appear in their scriptures, and so it causes some confusion. Like, what? This is obviously an animated species, and what in the world do we do with this? And it's good.
Great.
I'm really excited about it.
Well, hey, I'll be the first one to sign up once that's out.
Yeah, tell them, you know. Tell them to market it. Because I think this is an exciting, never slow down, but great characters. One named Pinecone again.
Nice.
Ascendant of Pinecone. Named for the character in this book. And some new characters, but the world's familiar, and it is just fun. I'm so excited about it, but I hope I can find a publisher for it.
Thanks for coming on and talking about your books, hopefully maybe we can get all those extra copies of the Riffs of Rhyme that are sitting on a shelf, get those picked up, and
yeah, I think
maybe they'll want to do the sequel.
I really do think I've never talked to anybody that really didn't like it. I think it could do a lot better if people knew about it.
Yeah. Well, get a talk with Cherry Dew and we'll get it at Deseret Books.
There you go.
Or you can go independent on Amazon Kindle. People do that? Yeah.
I have to do that, actually.
Yeah.
I think we've given our listeners good teasers, and I think they'll be excited to read your stuff and see what kind of thoughts are out there, see what infinity looks like, all that.
Yeah,
so thanks for coming on, Steve.
Oh, thanks for having me. This means the world to me.
All right, so there's our first Steve Peck interview. Well, we have another interview recorded that we're going to put with this block of science interviews that are in process.
And I am so excited for that block, by the way. I think that's going to be really cool to hear.
Yeah, it's lots of fun so far. And so next week on the podcast, Brian, why don't you tell them what you've got in store?
Yeah, so we're just going to be doing another one of the Sunstone compilations that I'm really excited about. As I said before, I had interviewed about like 30 different people, and there's so many like different diverse voices that were at that conference, and I think it's a good, these kind of episodes are good examples of just quick little snippets of the diversity that exists in the world of Mormon studies and internet Mormonism and some of these different people who are around. So I'm really excited. We'll go ahead and get that new episode out next week.
All right. Well, there you have it, listeners. We'll see you next time.